reconvene, and we're at item 5C. California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Mr. Harris, I think you're next. Good morning, or good afternoon, sir. Sorry.
Good afternoon. Chairman, members of the board, thank you for allowing the department to come here today. I'd like to start off, if possible, with going through Fall Creek Hatchery.
We just need your name.
I'd like to start off with the Fall Creek Hatchery update and then go through the hatchery release. And after that, I'd like to talk about the assurances. I'd like to give a small update on our wildlife surveys and then, if possible, address some of the comments that were made during the public thing.
Yep.
And then maybe address one of the comments that was made to KRC as well, if that's okay, just in terms of wildlife impacts.
Sure.
Thank you. Let me start off with some information regarding the Fall Creek Hatchery. The department currently has over 2.7 million juvenile Chinook salmon at the Fall Creek Hatchery. We will release these in three different life stages, fry, smolt, and yearling this year. The department currently still has 417,000 Chinook fry on hand that have yet to be released. Fall Creek currently has 93,407 coho salmon yearlings, which is 20,000 over our target release goal for production. Due to the accelerated timeline of the dam removal to reduce impacts from the dam removal project, the transfer from Iron Gate Hatchery to Fall Creek Hatchery happened while construction was still occurring there. Even with this condition, the fish being produced at the facility, they're healthy and growing faster than expected. So we will talk about the hatchery release. The hatchery success so far has been really good, and the hatchery is working very well. We need to remember that water quality conditions in the Klamath River with the dams in place does not provide the best conditions for hatchery releases for fish. In 2021, the department had to move over a million Chinook salmon smolts to the Trinity River hatchery as they cannot be released into the Klamath River due to sea shasta and temperature concerns. These fish spent 3 months at the Trinity River hatchery before coming back to Iron Gate Hatchery to imprint before being released after the sea shasta conditions in the Klamath River and temperature dropped. An additional 150,000 Chinook salmon had to be moved to the old Fall Creek facility at Iron Gate during this period to work through the same sea shasta issues. The good news is the impacts from sea shasta are expected to be greatly reduced after dam removal. In recent years, releases from Iron Gate Hatchery were determined through a meet and confer process with basin fisheries managers. This process was completed this year prior to the fry release and will continue for the additional releases this year. On February 26, 2024, the department, after consultation with the other fisheries agencies and basin fisheries managers, released 83,000 Chinook salmon into Fall Creek. The release was completed in line with the biological program for the hatchery to ensure optimal rearing conditions were maintained for the returning Chinook salmon and to take advantage of the high DO, low water temperatures, and dropping suspended sediment concentrations in the Klamath River. The fry experienced a high level of mortality from presumed gas bubble disease that occurred when they went through the Iron Gate Tunnel. At the time, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service rotary screw traps that were installed in the Klamath River were and continue to detect healthy fish in the main salmon. The department is currently working with NOAA, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and basin fishery managers to determine the best time to release the remaining Fall Creek hatchery, those are the Chinook and coho salmon I discussed. The movement of the fish below Iron Gate Dam, all releases will occur below Iron Gate Dam. The movement of fish below Iron Gate Dam is temporary and will not occur once Iron Gate is removed. Juvenile salmon monitoring continues to capture healthy fish in the main stem near 5, I-5, and other locations. When a determination is made regarding future releases, the department will notify the county. Switching over to assurances, the department understands the county's concerns related to impacts of dam removal on salmon populations in tributaries such as the Shasta and Scott River, and the perception that agricultural community members may be blamed for any potential fluctuations. Salmon populations are dynamic, fluctuate in response to many factors, including individual tributary conditions, water use, diversion operation, climate change, ocean conditions, and other factors. Any of these factors can affect population numbers and the number of fish that return in addition to any dam removal actions. The department has been transparent in identifying that among many factors affecting Klamath Basin fisheries, the operation of water diversion facilities and agricultural operations that impact in-stream flows in the Shasta and Scott and impact coho, salmon, and steelhead that are tributaries to the Klamath. These impacts have led to decreased population numbers in tributaries such as the Shasta and Scott Rivers. The department has continually supported actions to reverse these impacts, including the over $20 million in restoration dollars set aside just for Siskiyou County out of the $100 million in total for the state. This is in addition to all the projects that the department has funded for years to support the agricultural communities in improving conditions and infrastructure. At the same time, the department allocated $9 million specifically to help Basin Fisheries through the McKinney Fire Rehabilitation. And we continue to support and fund new projects in Siskiyou County through our grant portal and continually move those through the process. The department has a track record in Siskiyou County going back 20 years and longer of working with the agricultural community and Basin partners on fisheries issues in Siskiyou County. This includes not only funding mentioned below, but providing technical expertise, conservation engineering staff, developing programs like cutting the green tape, habitat restoration enhancement acts to get projects moving faster and easier to accomplish. We also complete adult and juvenile monitoring, so that information is available in a timely manner, and we do provide that on our weekly updates. We work with the county. We support collaborative projects such as the remote site incubation at Big Springs. And we try and keep the community and the county informed by sharing issues and sharing our fisheries information. So while there's no formal mechanism through statutes such as CSIF or an MOU that the county is requesting, the department is committed to continued financial, technical, and scientific support, as well as continued engagement with the Board of Supervisors in the status of Siskiyou County Tributary Basin Fisheries. But what I would add to this is that, you know, earlier a statement was made regarding, so we're all going to be gone in 3 years, and you know, how are we going to remember some of these impacts associated and everything like that? And I think that's something certainly that the department understands, and I think something we could definitely work on, sort of like an unexpected condition, so that we have something that we all agree on could have affected future population numbers coming back to the Shasta and Scott. So I understand what you're saying when you made that statement. So I think I'm, you know, definitely willing to go back to county staff and to get a little more information. And maybe it's not an MOU, but maybe it's an understanding document that basically where we agree that we understand that certain conditions related to, you know, the wet, warm winter and the out-migration of the Chinook fry, you know, that happened when we put our rotary screw traps in the Shasta River. There was a lot of Chinook coming out. It was a warm, wet winter. And they came out of the gravels early. They came out at a time when water quality conditions weren't optimal. You know, that's something that probably 3 years from down the road we could talk about and say, hey, that could have impacted returns. So I think I get what you're saying, and I think we can move forward with something. I think we just have to talk more about it.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, we received the letter of response prior to the fry, mortality that, you know, they didn't make it. But for instance, that 800,000 number is not coming back. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea behind this was whatever is related to the dam deconstruction project and its effect on the future run 3 years forward. We know how government works, and if there's an incident that they can point back to, if we'd only done X, I just don't want the Scott and the Shasta and the Upper Basin to be held in a place where that they're liable for something of that nature.
Well, if it's appropriate with the Board of Supervisors and Council, if I could reach out to your program manager with my council to have another discussion and see where we land after that bit of information, that would be great.
Okay. I think you get the drift, though.
I do get the drift. You know, when you start talking about MOUs and CISA and all that, we have to go through all the legislation to see if there's actually a mechanism through all the different codes to develop some type of MOU or some. So I think we'll continue to work on it.
Thank you.
So I just want to give a real quick update on our wildlife surveys. We continue to do our wildlife surveys daily around the reservoir footprints at Copco and Iron Gate. Since the initial, this is to actually look for animals that are entrained in the sediments or in distress as a result of drawdown and dam removal. Since the initial 8 deer were detected, we've only had 1 additional deer mortality, which was detected this weekend.
So what about the beaver that we got a picture of yesterday?
You know, that's...
I'm just asking.
No, it's a very valid question. I think the problem is, you know, not knowing the age of the beaver, not looking at the condition of the beaver, understanding that, you know, water quality conditions right now, you know, they do fluctuate, but at times they've even been down in the 40s, you know, in terms of NTUs. It's just hard to say, hey, that happened as a result of dam removal. We have to remember that while dam removal is happening, there's a whole natural process of life and death that occurs in wildlife, and I think anybody that's been either out hunting, fishing, walking, you've come across carcasses. I've spent many years on the river, so I've seen dead beavers, I've seen dead otters, muskrats, cadavers. So it's really hard to look at a picture and say, hey, this happened as a result of dam removal.
Did you find it as well?
What's that?
Beaver, did you find it?
No, because I believe that was 5 miles below Iron Gate.
by the Climacone Bridge.
Okay, yeah, I just got the picture this morning. So.
Can you do an autopsy?
I don't think they even have it yet. Right.
Yeah, I just found out about the picture this morning. So
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's a valid, but I think we do have to realize that, you know, in wildlife populations, regardless of dam removal, you're going to have mortalities. You're going to have other things that happen to wildlife other than dam removal. And so I just want to caution everybody that if you see something and it's 5 miles down from Irrigate and it's a mortality, it's not necessarily a result of turbidity or low DO spikes in January. So.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm just going to switch over really quick to the first comment that was made, and I apologize, I did not write down the names of the people that made the comments. So.
Okay.
But there was a question regarding the assurances letter in terms of short-term. We've heard short-term, 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 you know, and that it is based on water year type. And I think we have to remember that the project's not completed. We've completed, you know, the project's going through drawdown. They're just starting to work on COPCO. We have a whole construction season ahead. You know, when we look at short-term, thinking about next year and water year type, you know, Upper Klamath Lake is about to spill. Not about to spill, but it's pretty close to the top. You know, if we have a water year like next year, the dams will be removed, and you will have increased flow. That increased water year type will help flush the sediments out of the system. So I think when people are thinking short-term, it's not 2 weeks, it's not 3 weeks, it's not 4 months, but it could be, you know, a year. If we have a dry year next year, we may not get the high flows that come through and move that sediment out. We may have to wait till the next year. So I just think there's a thought that short-term was 2 or 3 weeks. And I think we have to look at it in terms of the project's not completed, and that we have to wait for a good water year to help us move that sediment out. Not all of it was going to move out in the first year. So somebody said we were paid in a grant to make fish, and that's why we registered to release them. And so we didn't take a grant to make fish. Pacific Corp is funding the operation of the Falk Creek Hatchery for 8 years. And so we make those fish. We're operating on a habitat genetics and management plan that identifies the amount of fish that we do produce. So that's where, sort of put my clarification on that. There was a statement made about we have to wait 3 to 4 generations before fish will come back. And I think what they were referring to is the fact that because we're looking at, you know, passive reintroduction, passive recolonization, you know, we're looking to 3 to 4 life cycles of these fish to naturally, you know, recolonize these areas, you know, the fish that they're building up below Iron Gate every year, to go this before we start actually thinking if has it been a success or not, and think about other actions that could be taken. But I think the idea is that we would have natural colonization within those 3 to 4 generations. Let's see. Who's responsible for the take? This was a call related to, you know, impacts of wildlife. You know, it's kind of a two-point question here. You know, in terms of the $25,000, we have to remember that the Klamath Dam Removal Project is fully permitted and went through a biological opinion process with NOAA, who's responsible for the protection of federally listed species. So they went through the appropriate steps and measures necessary for threatened and endangered species. You know, in terms of non-native fish, as a bass fisherman, I thoroughly enjoy, you know, catching non-native fish all the time. But the California Department of Fish and Wildlife is a public trustee agency for fish and wildlife resources in the state of California. So our primary mission is the recovery, promotion, and resiliency of native species. And this action, which will open over 400 miles of spawning of habitat for anadromous fish, certainly outweighs the recreational benefits of a warm non-native fish species. So in this instance, absolutely, when we transferred over from a lake system to a riverine system, there was a high level of mortality. But that's to promote the recovery and resiliency of Chinook salmon, steelhead, lamprey, and other native endemic fish. Let's see. Just regarding terrestrial wildlife, I just want to retouch on something that I may not have done a very good job at COPCO on, which is the idea that while we are losing, you know, 1,400 acres of lake, we're actually gaining 1,400 acres of critical weird deer winter range, as well as the deer that reside there all year. And this isn't just range that's going to be out there. This is range that now has revegetation consistent with the natural flora and fauna of the area. So this 1,400 acres is now an additional habitat available to the winter deer herd. Additionally, there's a lot of migration corridors that move through that lake area. And while deer definitely move through lakes, it's everybody's probably been out fishing. You go through the middle of the lake and you see the deer out there swimming by. But You know, this will actually promote the use and probably better migration for wildlife species through that entire area. Let's see. I think that was the ones I got down. Did I miss any?
Pretty good. As far as I can tell. I'm sure the board will follow.
Okay, great. I'll step down and...
Well, stay right there, and I don't... Well, wait, I do. Step down a minute. I do have a public comment. Sorry. William Simpson. Good afternoon.
It's still afternoon now. Good afternoon, Chair and Board. So, I'm recognized by the United States Coast Guard in deep water technical diving. This is my identification that works with the U.S. Coast Guard when I was out doing charters. I'm trained in the physiology of decompression sickness, otherwise known as the bends, or in the case of fish, gas bubble disease. So I'm considered an expert on it. I train other divers, and I can conduct technical dives at depth. So I was there the day Eric Jones had put those 850,000 Fall Run Chinook into Fall Creek. It was 850,000 according to Eric Jones. He was the supervisor up there, a senior supervisor. Okay, I looked him right in the eye, got his business card. Those fish did not die from gas bubble disease. There was not sufficient pressure at depth for the saturation of gases. This is very simple science. And, you know, it involves Boyle's Law and Henry's Law. We're looking at, basically, when you take a Coca-Cola and you pop the lid off, what you're doing is you're reducing the pressure above the carbon dioxide that's in solution. That is an example of what gas bubble disease is. If you have time to have all those partial pressure or gases in solution or in tissues, and then you suddenly remove the pressure, then you can get gas bubble disease or in a diver, it's called the bends. Those fish were not at depth long enough to develop the gases in tissue and in their bloodstream and then be decompressed quickly enough to get gas bubble disease. And he said they assumed. There's a lot of words being used up here. Expected, assumed, a lot of disclaimer language. So those fish didn't die from that. They died because of this toxicity in those sediments. And those sediments, again, I'm going to mention to the board, the CDM Smith Stillwater study that was conducted from 2009 to 2011 on the lake bottom sediments shows there are toxins there, a lot of them. DDT, dioxin, heavy metals, chromium, iron, aluminum, arsenic, cadmium are all present. Now, the varying levels doesn't really matter. It can be just under the EPA established limit, but they're bioaccumulative, which means in non-fluvial fish, they will build up. In crustaceans and mollusks and things, they will build up. So we keep hearing about all these plausible excuses for what's going on, but until that sediment up there is removed from the lake bottom and trucked out of the area, the river will continue to be sick. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else for public comment on this one? At the in-house, about online?
Showing them online.
Okay. Mr. Harris, you want to come back and we'll...
Yeah, do you want to...
Sure, you can,
yeah, so,
you can answer that.
I don't scuba dive and I don't... No, I'm not a fisheries pathologist that knows about. I know the Boyle's Law is probably PV equals NRT, but that's about as far as it goes.
That's Boyle's and Charles Law.
Okay. but I think the idea that somehow bioaccumulation would occur in a fish that's 522 a pound and moving through the system within 4 days, typically when I've worked with methylmercury down in the Sacramento systems, bioaccumulation takes time. So these fish were probably not feeding rapidly as they move through the system. And I'm totally willing to go back, and I will, and mention this to our fish pathologists that bioaccumulation has been mentioned here, but... with the short amount of time of release between the time we pick them up in the rotary screw traps. Once again, I'm not a gas bubble expert. And then it's basically the physical features associated with the bulged eyes and everything like that. That's a pressure-induced injury. So I will definitely take that back to our fish pathologist. But that's probably my response.
Okay, and we'll bring it back to the board. Supervisor Chris, you want to start?
I'd be happy to, yeah. I know I didn't start the last time, so sorry.
All right.
Cool. Mr. Harris, in regards to Fall Creek Hatchery, still interested in the history of the production?
Still can't find the numbers for you. Just to be, they're still looking for why we came up with those original numbers back in the 1960s for production. Okay. Our hatchery records just don't have them.
Okay. And to give you a little credit, it was, I think, 1917? So probably no one's on staff anymore?
No, no. Okay. So.
A little humor on a long day. But yeah, very interested in that. You know the historical numbers, why that number was picked, because it has a a major impact on what's expected to actually return to that area. It gives us a a historical context to it. Mm-hmm. I've used this analogy before. I stole it from a guy I had the honor of working for. It was Senator Doug Whitsitt from Oregon. And he wrote a letter and he said if the salmon had made it in large numbers to Klamath Lake, people would eat salmon rather than sucker fish.
Say that again, sorry? Can you repeat that? I didn't hear.
We didn't hear.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Oh, yes, right, the mix. I want a picture of this. Those my dad's in the back room.
Okay.
Back row, sorry. I'm used to the microphone. If I start yelling loud, then it dulls people out. So in regards to the, what I asked about was Fall Creek Hatchery. Fall Creek Hatchery was put in place, the original one, when Copco 1 was put in. And it was put in to replace the expected loss of production of salmon above Copper was the original reasons for it, I believe, from the historical documents. And what I was asking was how they came up with the number to produce from Fall Creek and how that number was set up, and then that sets the standard for down the road of how much is expected to return.
Okay. Yeah, we still haven't found it. I'm still looking, so.
Okay. And I'll talk loud here. Does Fish and Game deal at all with water rights in the Well, and the reason I bring that up, you're representing the
right.
state here.
Oh, yeah.
So I'll nail you for any other department. But there's this idea that in water rights, use it or lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some people that are along the Klamath River that are going to have legitimate concerns that if they were to divert water, not knowing what was in the sediment or what was in the material, that could impact their eventual groundwater or the soils there. And so I would hope the state would recognize that and not do a use it or lose it for those that would extract water from the Klamath River.
That's definitely a State Water Resources Control Board Water Rights Division issue.
Yes.
They would be the people to contact. I can get that information, the contact information for you or for staff if you'd like in terms of the person reaching out.
Just for seeing things down the road, yeah. I think for someone to have their water rights that they've had adjudicated for years get lost just because they wanted to err on the side of safety. And then in regards to the MOU or the agreement that the state would want to do, I like the things that were said in that letter, the ocean conditions, and all those other factors. In 2002, there was a fish kill along the Klamath River, and I'm sure you weren't part of it, but the Department of Fish and Game, those how dated it was, Department of Fish and Game's report squarely laid blame on the Two Lake Basin farmers because the water was diverted there. National Academy of Sciences came out later and said it wasn't the cause, it was more natural conditions, but it wasn't the ag guys. So as the Fish and Game rolls out, if there is any morbidity or anything happens to the fish, it has to err on the side of not rushing out any press releases or anything, because that can have a split the community and air things between people quite a bit. So very careful on that. And then one thing to add to that letter, of course, is the sediment that you read there. I don't have a copy of the letter, but sediment, which was talked about at a previous meeting with agencies on the Klamath ESA, but if sediment is a potential issue, and the Fish and Game recognizes that, and that could be a factor in any future fish kills. If sediment doesn't get released this year, next year's a dry year. 2 years down the road, so wet year, more goes down. Mm-hmm. I know the tribes have concern that it could lead to fish kill. Of course, we don't want that blame to be centered on either Two Lake Basin Ag, Shasta Valley Ag, or Scott Valley Ag for water diversions.
Yeah, absolutely. Sediment's a tricky one, and you should probably have a geomorphologist or somebody that deals with sediment. But I think people also need to understand that in a good way that that we're returning this river to its natural state. And there will be mobilization of sediment on an annual basis. And just like on the Sacramento River, where we have high storm events, there's going to be sediment transport, and you will have sediment landing on floodplains. That's what allow cottonwood seeds to regenerate in the spring. I was just down by Cocco Slough in Orland this weekend, and the boat ramps down there have about 6 to 9 inches of mud on there just as a result of the high flows that we've had. So as we move forward in this process and we start talking about the future and river conditions, which I hope we do get to the point, talk about what it's going to look like 3 to 4 years down the road, you know, maybe having a discussion about sediment and what sediment transport will look like in the system. That's not me. But I think it would be helpful so people know what a natural system like the Klamath would do sediment-wise and will do in the future.
I'll stop there. Thank you, Mr. Harris.
Professor Open?
Yes. I'll just cut right to the chase. I think we all would like to know how it was determined that gas bubble disease was the reason why those fish died.
Absolutely. I'm not a fish pathologist. I will carry that message back. But,
I think that fish pathologist report would be a great thing to have brought out into the public. And as you said, there are specific ways that those fish should have been examined for that determination. And it's obvious when a fish is looked at that's the reason why. I know that. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody else...
Right, I'm not part of the hatchery program, so I'll reach out to my colleagues. And
It would be great to know that, and it's a very specific how that's determined, and it would be great to know in a report somehow that that's the determination and what gas bubble disease really is, because clearly people don't understand what it is or how a fish is affected by it. And how it's caused, because it's not just a deep water issue when it comes to fish. It can happen in a fish tank. It can happen when a fish is transferred from one tank to another, or water to other types of water. So there's a lot of things that people don't understand about it. Might clarify some things. So just for public knowledge, I think that would be helpful for a future meeting, or for just out to public information. But I sure would like to know that.
Okay.
And thanks for being here, by the way. It's always nice to have your input and to help everybody understand what's going on.
Well, the department appreciates the opportunity to be here and will continue to provide not its best and brightest, but at least me to answer questions. So, until I get moved to Blythe.
Right to balance, Wayla.
Sure. You know, I think one of the things that we are up against, and I'm talking me as a supervisor and my fellow board members, is we get bombarded with a lot of information. So I'm just going to narrow it down to the stupid telephone lineman that I was working out there, just digging holes and setting poles. There's a dead beaver, right? I think the perception is something happens. I would ask, did you, cognizant of what's going on, do some testing so we can identify what it causes. That's asking above and beyond what you, yeah, I see dead I've been out there, I've seen the dead carcasses and all
right.
That. I think that's, again, valuable information, because we're constantly finding, dispelling rumors and
absolutely and
you know, bad information, if you will.
And then, we have the 225-2300 number. We've actually just got it automated to the point where when a message comes in, I actually get one of the messages regardless of throughout the region. So those need to be reported to us. We want them reported to us. We have, wildlife specialists here in Siskiyou County that to respond. So if we do see a dead beaver, I don't know if they'll necessarily always be able to get out there. Carcasses do disappear in the wild,
sure,
float away. But provide that information to us so we can.
I get that, but I'm just saying, because these people are stressed. There's significant impacts of what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
We need to make sure that we're looking at what's going on and not associate. Can we disassociate or associate it with what's going on?
Right.
Thank you.
With regard to that, can you leave that number to Ms. Davis over there, and we can put it on our website so that people have access to it?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Supervisor Howe.
Thank you. I want to come back to the memo that was written from Tina Bartlett back to the board.
Mm-hmm.
There's the first bullet statement I don't understand, and maybe it was not written correctly. It says... measures built into the project to minimize short-term impact, including the first bullet statement, is timing of drawdown to occur during the least sensitive biological period after a statement of Chinook salmon and coho salmon into tributaries such as the Scott and Shasta. They don't go into the tributaries, they leave the tributaries in escapement.
So, no, escapement is actually the number of fish that return to their spawning grounds. So, escapement would be the number, yeah, the number of fish. So, no, it's yeah, right. it's terrible. And then there's also the question of, is it that actually spawn or just actually return to their spawning grounds? And for like a spring run Chinook salmon, they return to whole. So you don't even have the pre-spawn mortality. Anyway, basically it was timed such that all the fish, the fall run Chinook salmon, the coho got into the tributaries, and it was timed so that the drawdown would occur after that. It would also occur after we were able to get all of our fish through Fall Creek Hatchery in Iron Gate, so we were able to gather all of our fish and get our hatchery, so we had 2 years of Chinook coho on hand as well as our fall Chinook. And then it was the drawdown occurred at this time when most of the juvenile fish had not emerged from the gravels. They're up in the tributaries. This section where we had the really high turbidity and the DO spike occurred at a time when, you know, all the juvenile fish were still up in the tributaries. As I did mention, for full transparency, it was a warm, wet winter, so the fish did start coming down out of those tributaries. It doesn't necessarily mean they left the tributaries, but we did capture them in our rotary screw traps. So that's what that first paragraph was supposed to.
Okay. I'm wrong then. It's like this fish stuff is confusing sometimes. the other questions I have, I want to echo Supervisor Ogden. It would be nice to see the report on the gas bulb issues in full transparency to let other folks know, because I can't tell you the number of conflicting information that I wrestle every week, and a lot of it's just the fact that you're doing a piece of this job and somebody else is doing a piece of the job, but the piece that's being done over here isn't communicated mm-hmm. through you or through us, so it's a mess. Kind of alarm bells kind of went off in my head when I heard today that the removal of the dams is timed in September to avoid fish returning exposed to sediment. I don't understand that, because by September the fish are already in the main stem. That's what I've always been told by Morgan Connect.
In terms of September, the fish are moving through the system. I think the projects, I don't want to speak over timelines for KARC, but I think the projects were proposed to be finished by September. I think that was the time frame. But these are adult fish moving in through the system. They will be there.
Which brings me to my concern, which was our concern in this memo. Is why are we always so enamored with low flows in August and September when the fish aren't present, for one thing? And then to hold Shasta and Scott rivers accountable for returning fish makes absolutely no sense. You can hold us accountable for the number of fish we produce, but what happens to them once they hit the main stem and go to the ocean? We have no control over that. But yet, the curtailments, the flow minimums, and everything that's imposed on the ag community is based on the returns. And that's what I was looking for in some kind of assurance that we're not going to get turned around and hammered for returners that are being killed in the main stem or in the ocean or some other unforeseen consequence of dam removal that we have no control over.
No, that's fair. We can talk about that more. I don't know how far we want to drift into Shasta and Scott, habitat availability and water temperatures and water use and groundwater levels in this conversation. I'm certainly okay to go there, but I think we have to keep in mind that there's limited habitat availability. Just using the Shasta watershed, for example, there's water quality concerns that really limit the amount of available habitat. And we have 10-year return of 43 fish with a hatchery component there. And so there is efforts underway through in-stream flow processes and stuff like that to increase that habitat value and everything like that. But I think that's also why the department as well as providing, you know, in-stream flow numbers and going through that process, is also working collaboratively to provide grant funding and working through other processes to fix those infrastructure and habitat things on the ground, too, so that at the end of the day, the Shasta watershed can function as well as it can.
We'll continue this because you're still not getting to the crux of the issue, and neither did the memo that came back to us from my perspective. It has to do with the survivability of those fish coming back in the next short term, if you will, 10, 15 years, and how that's going to trigger the Water Board and other regulatory agencies that continue to diminish our ability to provide a tax base in this county. And for my ranchers to survive, quite frankly, they're hearing right now that they're going to be confined to enough water probably to grow 2 cuttings. That's impossible as a business enterprise to make any profit in an ag community with 2 cuttings a year. All that does is pay the loan.
Respectfully, could I make a request then that we could get more feedback on the memo from the board or certain board members about what they were looking for? I think that would be super helpful.
I intended to do that with our monthly meeting this
I apologize, I wasn't able to make it last week.
But that didn't happen. So anyway, we will revisit this. It's a burning issue for me because the conflicting regulation and science and what's going on with this project.
So lastly, before we let you go here, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought we've had record numbers of coho out of the stock in recent years, in out-migrants and in-migrants?
Well, I would say on the Scott that there are cohorts that are slightly improving. I would say from a fishery standpoint that there's a celebration of slight increases, but the populations are still well below, you know, the populations that currently existed there. So we have sort of a false baseline of really low population numbers, and then we see an increase, and that is great and it's beneficial, and it's in part to a lot of the great work that's going on with the Siskiyou County Agricultural Community in Scott Valley. But I believe the depensation threshold, which is that threshold below which the populations are really at risk from stochastic and other events, I think it's, and I'm going to have to double check on this, I think it's like 6,500 fish. And I know a lot of people don't agree with that, but that's a number that's out there by NOAA that says basically below that.
That's NOAA one that we disputed from the very beginning. But,
so,
but I think that it's fair to say that the Klamath and the Scott and Shasta systems in particular have been the highest producing numbers of coho on the West Coast, as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I know.
I don't know the whole West Coast coho number, so.
Okay, well,
I will get them for the next board meeting, though.
I appreciate that. Go ahead, Supervisor Howell.
I just have a follow-up on what I was speaking of similar or prior, because you spurred my memory. So I know the department uses a number of fingerlings that have to go out for the number of returners. There's some kind of a ratio that the fish bios to predict whether or not the population is healthy, expanding, or contracting. I need to know what that number is, and if we compare that number historically to what we're seeing in the future, I'm okay with that. But if that number in mortality of returners goes way up beyond our control, then we've got an issue.
Would it may be helpful as our next county department meeting if I could bring our fisheries biologist Morgan Connectly or a member of the staff to really, I work with fisheries, supervised fisheries. I'm really a small mammal riparian ecologist at heart, so if everybody wants to talk about shrews, I'm there. But I think this is a great conversation to have. I'd just like to have it with
better
people.
Over the years, the department has targeted a 3% return of out migrants as adequate for returning spawners. I've never agreed with it, but that, I think that's what we've always been told. With that, Mr. Harris, I think we're going. County administration is next on this. Is there
next item?
Next item. So we're going to 5A. Is 6A? Is that correct? But before we go there, can I take 2 minutes because I need to check out something here before we go on. So we'll recess for just a couple minutes.